Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Ned Jakel, and attorney registration number 10952, I represent the appellant here, Luther Hill. Your Honor, there's no dispute in this case whatsoever that the victim in this case was sexually assaulted, and that the man depicted in the surveillance video was the assailant. The only issue at trial was whether or not that man, the man in the surveillance video, was Luther Hill, my client. In spite of that framework, we were allowed a police detective to give testimony that I would summarize as follows. First, that they broadcast that surveillance video. Secondly, that people called in response to that broadcast. And third, that those callers provided both the name and a photograph of the suspect, and that that named suspect was Luther Hill. And later, the detective also testified over objection that multiple callers said that the video depicted Luther Hill. But Luther Hill did not get to confront or cross-examine any of those people that called in tips. He could not confront and cross-examine these tipsters about the implicit content of their testimonial statements, and on the central and only issue in this case, the identity of the assailant.
Why do you contend the statements were testimonial since they were apparently made through an anonymous tip line?
I think they're very clearly testimonial, and the reason I think they're very clearly testimonial is they are in that core class of testimonial statements, Judge Webb, that is talked about in Crawford, which are statements that a declarant would A, reasonably expect to be available for use at trial, and B, that a declarant would reasonably expect to be used prosecutorially. Indeed, that's exactly what the detective explained was as the purpose of the crime scene.
Are those different tests, or are they the same? Because prosecutorial use implies a substitute for testimony at trial.
Are they different tests, or are they the same? I think they are similar, but I think they're, you know, I think saying used prosecutorially is slightly broader than available for use at trial.
Okay. So why would a person who is using an anonymous tip line, apparently because they choose to remain anonymous, conclude that it's likely that their anonymous statement is going to become effectively testimony at trial?
Because it's used to identify and prosecute a suspect in the case. As I explained in the reply brief, I know the state makes this argument that, they're anonymous, so they don't think they would ever be called a trial, but the focus isn't on the use that's going to be put to the declarant. It's not whether the declarant's going to be available, it's whether his or her information is going to be available for use at trial. It's not whether that declarant will ever be called to testify at trial. It's the use of the content of their declaration.
As testimony at trial?
Yes. Okay. And just as it was used in this case.
Okay.
But how would the information from the tipsters be any more damaging than the other information that was already in the record, including the defendant himself indicating that he was about to turn himself in? And if you believe the detective, you know, the mother's identification, the victim's identification, I mean, all of that combined, I mean, how does the tip information, how is it more weighty or more harmful than the other information that's already in the record?
It doesn't have to be more weighty, Judge Fox. It is evidence that the prosecutor used to establish identity, the only evidence in this case. The other thing that I would point out is, I mean, anything that the defendant said is ambiguous and subject to different interpretations. The alleged statement by Cynthia Lee, she disputed the trial. She said, that's what the police said. I said, I never said that. So we're talking here, and there is a valid confrontation objection, and we're talking here about standard of review that is a constitutional harmless error. It has to be. This court has to be convinced that it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in order to sustain this conviction.
Mr. Jakel, let's talk about the standard of review, because if indeed it is testimonial hearsay and there's an objection at the time of the admission, then it would be a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, is what you're asserting.
Yes, and I don't think the state disputes that.
All right. Now, what about when you're discussing later on when there was questions submitted by the juror and when the prosecution used the statement during closing argument, there were no objections? So what is our standard of review at that point?
Well, I've raised those as separate issues and under the plain error standard. Your Honor is quite correct that there was no objection to those, and those would have to be reviewed for plain error. However, I think those facts also factor into the Confrontation Clause analysis. I mean, the Confrontation Clause analysis turns on the use that was put to that evidence, and the prosecutor very clearly is using that evidence to establish the central issue in the case, to establish identity. Likewise, the juror question just shows that the jury is also considering that evidence for the truth of the matter asserted, that this is some evidence of identity.
Let me come back to the closing argument. Are you saying that somehow the lower court's evidentiary ruling has to be revisited because the prosecutor essentially in his closing argument without an objection being raised suggest that the jury should consider the statements for the truth?
Well, what I'm saying, I think, Judge Webb, is that if you look at Golub, if you look at the cases that I cited in the brief, particularly in the reply brief, if you look at that footnote in Crawford, the focus in the confrontation analysis is what was that evidence used for? What use was that evidence put to? And that argument by the prosecutor shows what use that evidence was put to. It was put to establish identity, the only issue in this case.
I'm not sure that answered my question, though. I mean, is your point that the lower court's evidentiary ruling then has to be re-examined based on what the prosecutor argued in closing without objection?
No, I'm just saying that it factors into us, this court, determining whether or not there was a Confrontation Clause violation or not.
Okay, I'm not sure I understand your point.
Well, let me ask this question, because I think this brings us to the Robinson case, which you have asserted in your brief was wrongly decided.
I've also distinguished it as well.
And right. So let's talk about the point of, does a later use of evidence admitted for a proper purpose, does later use improperly convert the testimony itself, or is that simply a 403 analysis, and why do you say it's one over the other?
Does the later use convert it to a 403 analysis? I think when we're talking about, for example, a 403 analysis in this case, I've alleged that as plain error, but I think the Mises case, the federal case, as well as the Professor Friedman's treatise, or I guess it's from the confrontation blog technically, shows that analysis is not just a pure 403 analysis. That analysis actually has to do with Confrontation Clause jurisprudence. That this not for the truth and run, as Professor Friedman calls it, as Justice Kagan called it in the dissent that I cited in the reply brief, that is just strictly an end run around the Confrontation Clause.
Yeah, well, I think, and in looking at the quotation from the professor, he's saying it goes beyond 403 because it may implicate confrontation. So I guess what I'm asking, is that still a 403 analysis and the prejudice happens to be because it implicates confrontation, or does somehow a later use of evidence improperly convert the character of that evidence from being non-hearsay to hearsay?
Well, I think it was always hearsay. I mean, I don't, and I may have a chance to get into it, but I don't buy for a minute this not for the truth rationale for admitting this evidence. I'm frankly stumped by your question.
Okay, that's all right. So then getting back to the court's admission of the evidence, the court, clearly in the bench conference, was proscriber limiting the use of the evidence, so it was to show what the detective did.
Right. It's a reason that was propounded not by the prosecution, just incidentally, but by the trial judge himself.
Right, so are you saying that the court did not admit it for the non-hearsay purpose?
Not if it doesn't tell the jury, and the jury's never let in on the secret, and the jury's clearly using it for its truth.
Okay.
Well, one juror may have been using it for truth. I mean, there's no reason to generalize that because the deliberations hadn't started.
Sure, but we get 12 of them, Judge. And if one juror is using it for its truth, it certainly, I think we could surmise that others may as well.
Okay.
The not for the truth rationale, which the judge came up with to admit this evidence, this is, I think, just a legal fiction. This is information that the jury doesn't need to know. This is not any different from asking the detective, well, why did you question the defendant? Well, because somebody told us he did it. Why did you search the defendant's house? Well, somebody told us he did it. Why did you arrest the defendant? Well, somebody told us he did it. Or if you want to go back to the, I think it's the 17th century, well, why did you lock up Sir Walter Raleigh in the Tower of London? As well, somebody gives an affidavit that said that he committed treason. Oh, good, I'm glad we got that cleared up. Let's turn to the next issue, which is, did Walter Raleigh commit treason? And then the prosecutor says, well, we have this affidavit. And that's what happened in this case, Judge. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You can lower the podium if you wish.
Would it please the court? My name is Melissa Allen, registration number 23155. I'm here on behalf of the people. I just want to start by clarifying a couple of things. Number one, no one, not one of these alleged tipsters said he did it. That has absolutely nothing to do with this case. What the quote tipsters said was, I think that guy looks like Luther Hill. And I would submit that that does not go to the truth of the matter asserted. And even if it did, how is it any different than the jury sitting in the trial seeing the same video clip that was on the news and making its own determination individually and together that the guy in the video kind of looks like the guy who's sitting in the courtroom? That's really all that this goes to. No one ever said, and not only do I think that looks like Luther Hill, but he's the one who committed this crime. The person who said he committed this crime is the victim.
Well, Ms. Allen, let me go back to something you were saying. It's that the jury could look at the surveillance video on their own and determine whether they think that it's the same person. So we have one juror who had submitted questions kind of asking about those identifications in the surveillance video. So if that juror was barely sure, not completely sure, what if that juror used that tipster evidence? Well, all these other people also thought it looked like him in the video. Would that influence that juror's independent view of that video to determine whether it was Luther Hill?
Well, I would note, Your Honor, that the question was never asked. So I think that's, you know, that was never mentioned in the opening brief, besides the fact that it made it sound like the entire jury was asking the questions. It's this one guy who's asking, you know, how many, he's asking this, in my opinion, unclear question, shall we say, how many people who had firsthand contact with the defendant said it was him, said it was Luther Hill, the defendant. And as this court's aware, in my answer brief, I cited to the record where the court was clearly confused by what the, and the defense attorney was confused by what the question meant. They both took it to mean how many people on that day, you know, looking through the crack in the stall, et cetera, already knew that that was Luther Hill. And maybe I'm wrong and that's not what they meant. Maybe they were talking about the tip. But I would first submit that it's definitely not clear. Secondly, I think by virtue of the fact that he's asking the question, he or she, the juror, they don't know if anyone had first. That person is saying, did any of these people, are any of these people dissimilar than me in my situation where I don't know him personally, but I'm seeing the video? Did any of them know him personally? And he never got the answer. It's a question. He's just wondering. And I don't think that, I mean, to the extent we're trying to get into the jury's mind, the juror's mind, I don't think that we can do that. The record that is clear about the jurors, and it was not mentioned at all in the briefing, which I think is actually pretty interesting, is that it turned out that two jurors remembered this case after it started. Let me just grab this. Sorry. So on the first day of trial, after, I believe, opening statements, the jurors went to the court or the bailiff and said, you know, I didn't think I remembered this. I didn't think I knew anything about it. But once they started doing opening statements, it kind of clicked. And one of the jurors, it turned out, had a doctor's appointment at the Skyline Medical Center and had received a flyer that had a still shot of the video. And she, you know, she said in chambers, I didn't know who it is. I still don't, you know, it's just, this happened. And she went on her way. But interestingly, the second juror not only saw the original broadcast of the video, of the grainy video of the unknown person, but after Luther Hill was arrested, he saw a known shot of Luther Hill and told the court that and said, you know, I saw before and just saw this guy, and then after the fact, I saw this picture of him, of the defendant. And he still goes on to say, when questioned by the court, that is going to have absolutely no influence on my verdict. I'm going to listen to, you know, the testimony as presented at trial. So if we're going to, you know, guess what the jury was thinking, I think we look to those statements that say they're not going to let that bother them at all, as opposed to surmising what an unclear question might possibly mean to one juror that never got asked. In the wrong order, but hopefully you know what I'm trying to say. And then, sorry, I'm going to move on to, I just want to talk about Robinson for a little bit, because I'm aware that, you know, defense counsel distinguished it, but, you know, I would suggest that, if anything, the informant's testimony in Robinson was more damaging. And I'm not saying that, I mean, I think Robinson was correctly decided, so I'm just saying it as far as what came out. And it was this, you know, the informant who doesn't show up at trial is with the detective in the car, and he's literally saying, that's the guys, those are the guys who sell me drugs, you know. And then he says it to another detective, the two people sitting in that van over there are the two people who sold me drugs. He gives descriptions of them, he gives their names. And all of this is not admitted for the truth of the matter asserted when those detectives testify at trial. Here we have nothing testified to from these unknown persons with respect to the crime itself. All we have is people saying, that guy looks like Luther Hill, and then a photo comes in. And if the court looks at the questioning of Detective Moore, you know, I still stand on the record that it was very carefully done to try to avoid getting into any more than was absolutely necessary. And the reason it was necessary to go into this is not because of any door being opened. And I kind of went down that road because that's how the argument went at trial with respect to, you know, the cross-examination and the rest. But let's take a step back even further and look at opening statements. The prosecution did not say one word about Crime Stoppers, about tipsters, about anyone looking like Luther Hill, about why we put, you know, how this photo lineup got put together. Not a word. When defense counsel got up, That's when it all started. The entire theme of this was, this is a rush to judgment. You know, the press got a hold of this. They didn't do any more work after they focused on Luther Hill. I mean, this whole theme started well before the questioning of the first witness.
Well, let me ask you this then. So we know there's a bench conference where the attorneys are discussing it, and the judge decides, all right, I will let it in, not for the truth of the matter asserted.
Correct.
But the jury is never told this. We have an indication of one juror who might have a question, which is premised on if that juror's consideration for the truth of the statement. And we have, in closing argument, the prosecutor making one statement saying that you can consider it for its truth, essentially. So if the jury never knows that it was offered for the not for the truth of the matter asserted, and there's indication in the record that they did, does this make that statement hearsay?
No, Judge. I think that they are two separate issues. The question is whether the evidence or the statements were properly admitted under the rules of evidence. And so that is its own, and it was raised as a confrontation issue, and so that is its issue right there, and it's decided right there. I would further say that the defense failed to request any sort of limiting instruction or anything else for the jury to, you know, be told you can only use this as consideration of whether this guy looks like the defendant, or, you know, or actually not even that, because the jury can do that on its own because it's sitting there. You can only consider this for, you know, the purposes of why the detective put together the lineup the way he did and why he proceeded with the case the way he did, which, again, separately was a completely relevant line of questioning, considering the fact that everyone was being kind of dragged through the mud for how this whole thing came about. But anyway, so that's the evidentiary issue. Then you move on to allegations of error, for instance, prosecutorial misconduct with respect to two lines of argument in a 15-page argument wherein the prosecutor, and I know that the court probably is aware of the exact language, but it was something like, and we have more than that, we have some tipsters calling in and saying that it's Luther Hill too, or something to that effect. And again, that's a plain error issue. It has to do with prosecutorial misconduct allegations. It doesn't change the nature of how the evidence came in the first place. You can't bootstrap and go backwards when you're talking about what is properly admitted evidence or testimony.
Okay, so is that what Robinson is saying? It's not a hearsay issue, but it's really an issue of misuse of non-hearsay evidence, which would be a 403 analysis.
I believe that that is what Robinson is saying, yes. And here, again, I think it's less prejudicial because you've got this. I mean, I can't think of another scenario where, you know, the whole argument is over this particular evidence of these tipsters saying that looks like this person, when you've got the jury that's sitting there looking at the exact same thing that was on the news, looking at the defendant in the courtroom and kind of coming to its own conclusion on what I would consider is a side issue, because what they're listening to is the evidence of identification of the perpetrator in the bathroom, who, of course, we are seeing that person on the video also, but they're listening to the victim say, you know, I was in there with him for 8 minutes in this close proximity. Not only did I unequivocally identify him from the photo lineup without hesitation, but I'm telling you that's him in the courtroom. And I would submit to this court that is not the only direct identification that we have of the defendant. And if there's any suggestion that a direct identification has to occur in the courtroom, that's absolutely wrong. I think that Mrs. Hill's denial of saying anything only helped the prosecution because it's so clear she's covering for her son, and it wouldn't make sense for her statements to come out any other way. And I would also suggest to this court that one of the witnesses did, in fact, identify not the guy in the video, but I can't pronounce her last name, Casey G, a witness. She saw the defendant twice on the news, and if you read the transcript, I think it's very clear. She originally, not on the news, on the day of the assault, like an hour later, she went and saw security and she got to see the video right there. That's when she watched it and she said, yes, the guy in the video is the guy that I saw. After the defendant was arrested and his known picture was put on the news, she talked to the detective, and in fact, the defense attorney brought this out on cross-examination. She says, yeah, after he was arrested, I saw his picture, a known picture of Luther Hill, and I told the detective, that's the guy I saw in the bathroom. So even if we have to get to the identification, there's more than just the victim's identification here. And I see I'm getting close. Unless there are other questions, I'm getting close to running out of time. I would stand on the fact that this is not hearsay, it's not testimonial, it was properly admitted evidence, and you can argue it 20 different ways, but it doesn't make it 20 times worse than what it was, which was really only, this guy looks like Luther Hill. So I would ask that this court affirm defendant's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Well, it's really interesting that Ms. Allen would now say she knows what it was that the tipster said, because in her brief she told me and told this court that we don't know what the tipster said, and I can't and did not cite to any statement that was made by the tipsters, but now she knows precisely what it was they must have told the Crime Stoppers line, that guy looks like Luther Hill. Well, that's not how the prosecutor characterized it. Here's what the prosecutor says. That Cynthia Lee was not the only person who knew that the person in those surveillance videos, because Crime Stoppers received several tips that this person, the police were looking for, this person who sexually assaulted the victim, it was Luther Hill. Not that he looked like Luther Hill, but it was Luther Hill.
So I take it the record doesn't include any evidence of what actually was on the tipster line.
That's correct. It's all by implication, and it's all by very skillful implication by Detective Moore and the prosecutor.
And all the tips were anonymous?
As far as we know, right, on this record.
Was the photograph mailed to the TV station or emailed? Or
It's not clear from either, it's certainly not clear anything that was revealed to the jury, and it's not clear at all from the bench conference, to me at least.
Okay.
Let me sort of go back a little bit to this purported non-truth reason, because it occurs to me that this is, if the evidence is truly admissible for a non-truth purpose, then its reliability, its veracity, its truth value must be not entered into that calculation. But here, if we really need to tell the jury why the police did what they did, then we're doing that to show that the police did not act irrationally, that they had a rational reason for inserting Luther Hill's picture into the photo array.
Okay, and isn't a tip such a rational reason without going to the credibility of the tipster?
Well, it depends. It may be, and that's why it's prejudicial, Judge. It may be if this person knew Luther Hill, if this person had no bias against Luther Hill. For all we know, this tipster could have been the assailant himself who put that handprint that did not match Luther Hill's handprint.
Now, that was my toilet stall. My question was a little different. If defense counsel in opening statement trashes the investigation as a rush to judgment. And that at least implicates an issue of the good faith of the police. Isn't taking action based on a tip indication of good faith without getting to the credibility of the tipster?
No, not at all. It's only, in fact, Judge, I would turn that around. It's only evidence of good faith if the tipster is credible. So implicit
a policeman would do nothing about a tip unless he had a reason to conclude that the tipster was credible?
No, but if the policeman receives a tip from someone that is known incredible and he acts on it, it does not show that he is acting rationally.
But you added a fact that wasn't in my question. You said the tipster was known to be incredible. I'm saying, suppose you know nothing about the tipster. Wouldn't a reasonable policeman do something about it?
It's only shows the policeman's good faith if he has some reason to believe the tip, and that goes to the prejudicial nature of this evidence.
All right, thank you.
Sure. I think for the most part, Ms. Allen makes a very good argument as to how the evidence should be viewed and how it should be argued to a jury. And what I hope the court does is invite Ms. Allen to make that argument to a jury that has not been exposed to inadmissible testimonial hearsay, and ask the court to reverse Mr. Hill's conviction.
The case stands submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.